cannot show me a single traditional linear business that has the same types of upper growth capabilities as a platform. And that's because platform economics are entirely different to traditional linear commercial economics.
Welcome to Gigging, Everything in the Sharing Economy podcast. And I'm your host, Mark Anthony Peterson. This is the podcast where founders, CEOs, market makers, and market leaders come to discuss the future of the sharing, gig, and circular loop economies. We have a fascinating show for you today. In episode 22, I interview Devin Hughes, the founder and CEO of BuyMe, the Dublin-based grocery delivery platform. Devin is shaking up the market and making big moves in the EU. Devin is the chairman of the sharing economy in Ireland. He worked for Salesforce.com as part of the strategic enterprise with a focus on the FMCG and manufacturing sectors. Devin holds a degree in finance from the National College of Ireland. Guys, if you want to learn why platforms are valuable, you need to listen to this episode. Devin gives a tutorial on platform economics and explains why players like DoorDash and Postmates will have to pivot or die. Now, I got to give you a geek warning. Devin is my brother from another mother. We both worked in the energy sector. We both launched fingerprint businesses. And now we both are building platforms in the grocery sector. By the way, we both love Iron Man. And I almost pulled out my Iron Man helmet in the middle of the podcast interview. If you're a geek for the sharing economy, you will love this episode. Before we get into the interview, let me share some exciting news with you. Eleanor Tucker, yeah, from episode 19, remember her? She will be joining Gigging as a co-host on our Gigging News segments. And the first episode will post on July 21st, 2020. If you missed episode 19, go back and check it out. Eleanor Tucker is a superstar when it comes to platform and platform economics. She launched the first platform marketing agency, helping platform entrepreneurs solve that chicken and egg problem. This podcast episode is sponsored by Sierra Consulting, a leading technology and business management consulting firm focusing on startups, small and family businesses. Sierra Consulting believes that an idea can launch a business, but a strategy can take it global. Find Sierra Consulting at Sierra.com, C-E-Y-E-R-O.com. And now my interview with Devin Hughes, CEO and founder of the Dublin-based grocery delivery platform, BuyMe. Welcome back to the podcast. We have an extremely exciting show for you today. We have the CEO and founder of BuyMe. That's the Dublin-based startup that kicked off in 2015 and now is serving 500,000 people in Dublin, and they are closing the gap for people who have to shelter in place and bring groceries to your front door. But here's the twist. For many of my American audience, they bring the groceries to your door in less than an hour. That means if you have a hunger or a need for something immediately, these are the guys that can get it to your door. Let me tell you a little bit of what I know about Devin. He's the chairman of the sharing economy there in Ireland. He worked at Salesforce.com as part of the strategic enterprise team with a focus on FMCG and manufacturing sectors. He holds a degree in finance from the National College of Ireland. Devin, welcome to the podcast, and tell us a little bit more about who you are.
Well, thank you very much, Mark. I really appreciate you having me on. Yeah, but look, I'll give you the very brief background, I suppose. You know, my background, it's not technology, and it's not grocery for the most part. I spent the vast majority of my career working in the energy markets. And so, you know, I would have worked in, you know, gas and electricity supply, working with some of the largest manufacturers, retailers, and pharmaceutical companies to hedge and manage their gas and electricity portfolios. Spent the latter half of my time in the industry working in an area called demand side management, which is where you would work with the national grid operator for the electricity sector, and help them balance supply and demand so that the network could reach equilibrium. And so, yeah, so Buymi is my fifth business. So I've had four spectacular failures that have gotten me into this mess. And in 2014, I was getting the itch to start another business. I had taken 2 years break after lucky number four. And I stumbled upon the grocery e-commerce market and instantly recognized it as a commodity market with a lot of the same characteristics as the electricity sector. And decided that the distribution model that was being used for online grocery was not going to be able to scale with the long-term demand curves that were coming. And so I felt that this is probably one of the most interesting sectors to spend a decade or two of my career.
So what were some of those problems that you saw with the current model that led you to believe that a delivery service that could bring groceries to your door in less than an hour would be a better solution?
It was dysfunctional. The entire market was dysfunctional. So, you know, my big part of my role when I was in the energy sector was macro market analysis. So looking at, you know, the big picture, what was happening within, you know, the geopolitical climate or within the, you know, the weather sector to understand what shifts that might have and impact that might have on gas prices. When I looked at the online grocery market for the first time, I could see that it was a £9 billion sector, just online grocery, and just in Ireland and the UK, which is just two markets, a £9 billion market size, but it was losing £300 million a year. So that was the aggregate losses of all of the retailers combined trying to service this channel. Ultimately, they were sacrificing profits for growth, which is fine when you have a small market. Subsidization is a very common thing. The gas markets themselves are subsidized by government because that's how our societies function. But when I looked at the long-term demand curves for online grocery, the Irish UK market alone, forget about anywhere else, was set to double to £22 billion in just 10 years. And so my free market economist hat went on and I said, well, if you have a rapidly expanding market, heavily compounding losses in a short window of time, it's very likely that market will experience a correction, a disruption. It'll come in one shape or another, but there will be a change of pace. And as I said, I just thought this would be an exciting space to be in and wanted to be a part of that shift.
So then let's start breaking down what your company would become. As you looked at the different players and the number of players and this pending pent-up demand, you started to put pieces in place that would address it. What did you do first and how did you start to get that initial traction in the market?
I researched every inch of the market, the economics, the cash flows, the margins, the competitive structures, the players, the retailers, stakeholder structures. Really tried to understand a lot of the fundamentals of the market. So a lot of analysis, spent about probably 6 months analysis, like just, you know, really kind of breaking the market apart and trying to understand it and trying to understand where the inefficiencies were sitting. So I could see that, okay, to put it in comparison, every single market in the world has two things, one electricity grid, one gas network, right? Right. The reason we have one of each of those things is that it would be prohibitively expensive to have multiple electricity grids and multiple gas networks, because we need to use shared infrastructures to reach economies of scale, particularly when shifting large amounts of commodities around, you know, to different parts of the market. In grocery land, in Ireland and UK alone, there was 9 separate distribution networks. The Tesco network, the Sainsbury's network, the Ocado's network, all trying to do the same thing, build warehouses and vans and distribute goods through a vertically integrated linear distribution model chain. And again, the one thing that, you know, if you look at commodities, it's about decentralized networks, not vertically integrated, linear, it's all about decentralization so that you can actually, you know, reach distribution in a more efficient way. And so that was the fundamental kind of, I suppose, thesis was, okay, if you're going to build something, you need to build a shared infrastructure. And then I thought, okay, well, you know, surely someone's done this before, and they have. I think the earliest example of online grocery is Webvan, which is very popular case study in the US. But actually what happened was is when Webvan in the US went bust, the grocery retailers in Europe took the Webvan model and have been using that for 2 decades, losing money while doing it. And so we wanted to create a system that didn't require heavy capex. And realistically, if you look at the grocery sector, the infrastructure is already there. Grocers have gone out and built supermarkets in the best locations to reach as many households as possible. And so what we wanted to take was a pure platform approach where we would sit on top of the assets, not own the assets, but sit on top of them like the electricity national grid operator would. So in most markets, your national grid operator does not own the national grid. They simply sit above it and they manage supply and demand and they manage the capacity within the network to actually shift that commodity. And so that's exactly the thesis that we wanted to do. And so with that, I decided that this was going to be a pure platform technology play. And given the fact that I had no background in technology or grocery, I figured it was going to be a very hard sell to get investors to back me. And so I quit the energy markets and I decided to go get a job with Salesforce, the biggest platform company I could find. And so that I could do what I considered a master's in platform.
And that makes sense. So you took a step back and looked at this and saw that a device agnostic software solution was the best way to leverage what needed to be a complete industry solution shared amongst all the players to reach and tap into that growing demand.
I would say retailer agnostic.
Okay.
So that's the key difference is that it's a shared infrastructure for all retailers to feed onto, and rather than just software, it's platform. And that word platform, and at the time I didn't really understand it, but obviously I've gone on quite a journey, and the understanding of the platform economy, of the sharing economy, has taken on a whole new meaning, not just for me, but in the world as a whole. And so really understanding how platform economics change supply chains and value chains is a key component as to why what we're doing and why it's having an impact.
Let's peel that onion so the audience can understand that nuance. You know, in my last startup, I kicked off a fingerprint platform back in 1999, and at the time we were facing the same kind of situation, a very high capex current solution with devices that cost $100,000 a piece. So there were only a handful of organizations that could afford to buy a live scan device. We figured that a device agnostic platform that linked all of this equipment and let the industry share the solutions versus buying hardware was the best way to manage both the employees, the companies, and the ultimate receiver of the data, the FBI and Interpol. And so, yeah, that was an early attempt at trying to manage the economics of a shared solution. But can you peel that onion for the audience and help us understand the dynamics of it and why it works for your business model?
Sure. So the way in which, if you want to really understand platform and the sharing economy and what it actually means, because there's quite a macro way to look at this because you can go down into rabbit holes and sometimes it's hard to really separate the wood from the trees. So I try and take it as high level as possible, which is if you look at what has happened since the inception of the internet, primarily due to connectivity and network creation across not just globally, but at a most granular individual and device level, we have seen a global shift in the way economic activity is managed and mediated. And what I mean by that is that we have shifted from an organizational economy of the 20th century, where most economic activity and labor was managed and distributed by large single institutions like your General Electric and your Rockefeller, Standard Oil, and your Ford Motor Company, or the real industrial. That was the first evolution of economic management came from the corporation that we developed in the Industrial Revolution. So what's happened since is that we've shifted to this now market-based, peer-to-peer economy, for the 21st century. And what I mean by that is that now in almost every single country, in every single industry, you have data-driven platforms that are sitting above their respective markets and industries, not within them. And there's a very big difference between sitting in a market and sitting above a market, because the difference between a decentralized platform and a linear traditional corporate is that a decentralized platform can in theory grow to the full size of its marketplace. That is the difference. So if you, and I'll give an example of the grocery. I'll use the grocery industry as a way for us to visualize this. The grocery market, Ireland, UK, again, these two markets combined, is roughly 250 billion euros. It's total market size, total spend on grocery across all channels in that vertical. The largest player in that market is Tesco's. Tesco is the largest grocery retailer in Ireland, UK. Their market cap is 23 billion as of the last count. Okay, so the largest player in a 250 billion euro market is only worth 23 billion. And the reason being is that they're competing for market share with a number of other, up to 9 other vertically integrated grocery retailers. And now they're going to be going head to head in grocery with a business that is a $1 trillion company, 4 times the size of the entire market. And that's Amazon, because Amazon is a decentralized platform. It's not vertically integrated. Now, it has vertical integrated aspects to its supply chain, but it's not a vertically integrated linear organization. It's decentralized. It operates as a marketplace. It operates as a platform. And then it has supply chain built in underneath. So really unique. And so, again, thinking about platforms in general, platforms usually sit above their market. And what they do is they collect local economic information. And the reason the word platform is important here is because that is exactly what it is. So if you go back to the earliest forms of marketplaces, right, you can go back to Roman times. And what were marketplaces used for? They were used to collect local economic information, right? Mm-hmm. And exactly. It was really easy to be a trader in ancient Roman times, because you could go down to the market and you could walk around all the stalls and you could collect all the pricing and the quality and the quantitative and qualitative economic information of your local market, right? What happened was, fast forward, our population exploded and you had the creation of corporations. And the reason corporations came about was to collect local economic information and then create supply chains and value chains and process. And that was how our economy started to actually function, okay? Now you have data-driven platforms that usually connect with various different stakeholders. And I'll give you Biomi's example. We have supercomputers sitting in everybody's pockets. And when our shoppers, when our customers transact on their little supercomputers, they're generating data and cash flow and transactional information, local economic information, product pricing, shelf availability, behavior patterns, purchase patterns, category performance data. All of this rich information is being generated just by the interaction of these two stakeholders. And what our platform does, what our algorithms do, is that soaks up that local economic information, processes it in high frequency, and then allows different stakeholders to create new value where it didn't previously exist before because of connectivity. And so that's, again, the fundamental difference. Then you look at any industry. You look at the financial industry. You've got the likes of Revolut, Monzo, N26, these new banking systems. You've got Amazon as a perfect example. And then when I talk about growth, you think about, you know, Google. Google is nearly the full size of the Western search market. That's incredible. Amazon's nearly the full size of the total retail Western e-commerce market. Mm-hmm. You know, you have Alibaba, exact same over in Asia. So you cannot show me a single traditional linear business that has the same types of upper growth capabilities as a platform. And that's because platform economics are entirely different to traditional linear commercial economics.
And to me, that makes sense. That was the problem I was trying to solve with my business: information asymmetry. Mm-hmm. If I knew that there was demand and I could link that demand with open capacity anywhere I had my platform operating, I could grow faster than the vertically integrated players who were out there searching in their silos for those opportunities.
Growth is a very interesting component to that as well, because the reason these platforms grow so quickly is network effects.
Right.
right? So most businesses, and I'll give you our example, when we bring a retailer on, we benefit from this network effect of that retailer's existing customer base, and they open up that customer base to us, and we grow faster. And if you're a traditional business, typically you have to go and compete individually for your markets. You don't benefit from that network effect.
Right. And which lifts all boats. That co-opetition then gives them the opportunity to even explore some unique strategies that they probably couldn't pursue as a vertically integrated retailer. Now that they're part of the network. And that's what I love about what happens when you overlay a platform on an industry, is that now even mom and pop grocers can compete if they tap into that network effect and benefit from the data that's being collected and see where they can carve out unique niches because of what the data is showing them.
So, yeah, absolutely.
So as the pandemic set in, that must have supercharged the demand for what you were providing to the industry. Tell us about that. And did that put a strain on the business that made you step back and learn or think about ways that you had to grow or reposition the platform?
Yeah, so it was certainly a very interesting period. I mean, same day grocery is one of the fastest growing channels in the sector. So we've been growing really quickly for about 18 months or so. And that's really when we kind of raised our first round of funding and we were able to really get some wheels underneath this thing. Q1 was unprecedented. It was a black swan event globally. And it was really interesting in the dynamic that it basically extracted all revenue from the services industry and hospitality industry and injected it into the grocery sector. So grocery as a whole globally was a major beneficiary of COVID. As a natural stakeholder within the market, and so you're gonna have winners and losers on both sides of an event like that. So we found ourselves obviously very uniquely positioned, and I think probably the most interesting dynamic change was that, you know, what we had initially been working on, which is a game changer of a service for grocery, not just for consumers but for retailers, all of a sudden overnight became this essential service.
Right.
You know, because people couldn't leave their homes. And so I would like, you know, really, if I think about what it meant for us, I would like to think that actually it the work that we were doing just took on a much higher meaning, you know. And I think that was a really unique experience. I mean, the sheer level of volume, I mean, we surged 300% in the space of a week. We did a week's worth of volume in a day. You know, the volume change and the step change was sudden and instant. We certainly had to rise to the occasion. I'm glad to say we had zero downtime. Our platform remained stable, and that's a testament to the incredible work that our team have put in. But what it did mean is that we had to radically review our commercial and funding strategy for the remainder of the year, and really understand that the landscape had changed and things were different. And we had to make sure that we were able to rise to that challenge.
Yeah, that's what I'm seeing with a lot of the platforms, is that over time, they become almost viewed as a public utility. They become that important to society that they are no longer viewed as a traditional for-profit entity, but more of a public utility. You see that with transportation, with Uber and Lyft now looking at themselves as more of a transportation management company.
Yeah.
And certainly with your platform, in this crisis certainly highlights it. You are right alongside the electric and gas and other players, a critical element for the public. While we're talking about the platform, I'd be remiss if I didn't give the audience a chance to learn a little bit of what makes your experience different than other players. So can you step us through some of the unique preferences shoppers experience when they go to your platform and how they get the groceries to their front door?
Sure. So the experience from the consumer side is, you know, you download the Buy Me app. It's free across iOS and Android. You register, you put in your postcode, your zip code, as you guys would call it. And we then present retailers of choice that we've mapped or partnered with. And we've got their full category listing. So you then choose the retailer you want to shop with. And once you've chosen the retailer you want to shop with, you're more or less in a branded retail experience at that point, although you're still within the Buy Me platform. And you can fill your basket, view categories, and all the rest that goes with it. And then, you know, as you're filling your basket, our algorithm, we call it Jarvis. I don't know if you're an Iron Man geek like we are.
I'm a huge Iron Man geek.
Excellent. Okay, so you know exactly who Jarvis is.
Exactly.
Brilliant. Excellent. It's almost like we planned that.
Exactly. There you go. Now, you don't want me to put my helmet on because I got that right now.
So we've named our system Jarvis. And for any of your listeners who aren't total nerds like we are, Jarvis stands for just another rather very intelligent system. And so when our customers are processing or filling their order, you know, browsing, Jarvis is always watching. And it sounds a bit creepy, but he is. He's always watching. He's looking at what items you put in your basket, what retailer you've selected, where your location's based, etc. And by the time you get to your checkout page, Jarvis has already gone into the network. He's looked at where all the shoppers are at present and where they're forecasted to be for the next 7 days. And he will then present delivery slots to you based on the availability that's there. You choose the slot of your choice, and you can choose any 1 hour slot into the next hour and 7 days into the future. You choose the delivery slot that you want and you place your order. At that point, you put your feet up, you put on the teapot and you go and have a rest. Your order is then fed in. Jarvis will then reanalyze your order and will constantly, until the point at which he deems it necessary, will constantly re-optimize and rebundle your order with different orders of a similar nature. You know, orders from the same retailer in the same location due at the same time with the right mix of basket items. And then at the very most opportune time, the very last moment, he will release that order to a personal shopper. One of our personal shoppers, an independent contractor, person who has their own car, their own smartphone, they will book sessions on the platform with Jarvis a week in advance. So they tell Jarvis a week in advance where and when they're going to be available for orders. Jarvis releases the order to them. And then they use the shopper app, which we've designed, to be redirected to the very best logistical retail site, so the most optimal retail site, to pick, pack, and prepare the orders on behalf of their customers. They pay for the items like a normal customer would. We use a prepaid debit card. Jarvis sends the money to them when they accept the order, so they know that they have the money available. And then they pay for the items like any normal customer would. And then at that point, they leave the store and they're routed to the customer's location, again, via the most optimized route, because Jarvis will look at all the traffic conditions, weather conditions, and all the variables that are at play. And that's more or less our supply chain end to end.
Now, one of the things that we experienced here in the U.S., stockouts, particularly, you know, on platforms like Shipt, when the customer would select a particular retailer, be it Target, Publix, Kroger, some of the traditional brands here.
Yeah.
How does Jarvis handle that? Are you looking at inventory? Are you tapped into that aspect of the retailer system to know
if you
should redirect?
On-shelf availability is one of the single biggest challenges for grocery retail in a normal day. When you throw in a global pandemic, every single retailer experienced a significant shift in demand within one day, and our entire food supply chains were completely thrown off. All of the forecasting and data that drives shelf stocking is not just driven at a retail level, it's driven at a brand level. And it threw all of our models off. The entire industry, everyone's model was completely blown. And it took about a week and a half, in Ireland anyway, for supply chains to balance out again. So we saw a sharp increase in basket size, so people bulk buying. But we also saw a sharp increase in the number of items being removed from the basket by shoppers because of stock availability. Now, I'm glad to say that the bounce back was fairly quick. And we've definitely seen supply chains, you know, recover very, very quickly. And now that the market is trading significantly ahead of its usual forecast, but very stable.
Is that the next opportunity for your company? Because what I saw, I drive back and forth to go visit my relatives in Alabama. That's a 3.5 hour drive. I passed probably a dozen Costco stores in that drive. And I'll pull in to some of them to pick up items to bring back and forth, particularly when we're at the peak of the pandemic. There was a store in Montgomery that the entire back wall was filled with tissue paper. The one in Atlanta, same company, had none.
Yeah.
Now, if the shoppers in Atlanta knew that there were paper in Montgomery, Costco would make more money.
Yeah.
More customers would be happy. But there was a silo even within the company when it came to inventory management that left items unsold in one market that needed to be sold in another.
Is that
an area that you see?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think, like, again, the data that gets thrown off in this process is so rich. There's like FMCG, high frequency consumer data, is some of the richest and most valuable data set that you could possibly have. And we can talk a little bit about what that means more for platforms in a minute. But we see on-shelf availability. We've integrated with our retail partners. So we have data feeds that give us their stock availability on a daily basis, but not at a store level just yet. And we have to work down to drive that down. That's more integration. And the longer the bigger our platform becomes, the more integrated we'll naturally become with the supply chain. And we'll get better and better and more granular. That'll be a natural part of the journey. But the data that we throw off then is really rich, which we can tell our retail partners at what time certain item categories became unavailable in what stores. And not more importantly, we can also tell them what the opportunity cost was, because we can show them what the demand would have been had we been able to get that item. And we're not able to get a good substitution. So there's always going to be a certain percentage of lost orders, lost volume, lost revenue because of unavailability. And we're actually able to quantify that for our retail partners. Again, an entirely new data insight that did not exist prior to this platform.
And that data insight really excites me, because that's the kind of data that's going to change the industry, I think.
Yeah.
Because it can drive where stores are going to be built. It's going to drive whether or not the store is even a store that's a dark store versus one that has human operations in it, you know, that operates more like a warehouse versus a traditional grocery store. Is that what you see as well?
Yeah. So one of the things that I'm most excited about with this sector is how data flows, or in this case, does not flow effectively across the market and across all the various stakeholders. So you look at the energy market, the way in which the energy market trades and operates is on real-time data. Mm-hmm. There is no other way to trade energy unless it's real-time. And so an example of this is 2014. One of the big events that happened was Russia annexed Crimea. Mm-hmm. Everyone will remember that event. Not many people realized how big of a deal that was in the energy sector, but one of the largest gas pipelines to Europe runs directly through the Ukraine. Ukraine owed Gazprom, which is the largest gas supply company based out of Russia, £6 billion. And Ukraine was not paying it up. And Gazprom started to close the tap. That tap doesn't just hit Ukraine, it feeds Europe. So immediately as a trader, so anyone working within the energy gas sector, you could immediately go to the International Commodities Exchange. You can look at the impact of this announcement on the price of gas, and you can make commercial decisions, hedging, planning, whatever it might be, buying data, and you can make decisions based on that real-time information. Grocery, on the other hand, has a real information asymmetry problem, whereby a lot of the data is actually being collected and siloed within different stakeholders, mainly retailers. Retailers don't know how to share that data without compromising their commercial position, because they don't want to share, you know, a lot of brand data, because they don't want the brands to know how much of what they're selling, et cetera, and that complicates mm-hmm. negotiations. But the benefit that we provide is that we have multiple retailers on our platform. We generate this data, but then we anonymize the retailers. And because we have multiple retailers on the platform, no one knows exactly where that data was created, but we're able to give real-time market insight data that is still incredibly rich and valuable in terms of optimizing the market, but without compromising any individual stakeholder. And this, again, is part and parcel of how do you fundamentally change the way a market works. You look at the supply chain, you look at the value chain, and you look at the information chain that underpins those markets. And as you start to change that, you can actually start to really extract and create new value that didn't previously exist.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. I worked with an Equifax spinout called ChoicePoint. And one of the biggest products the company offered was a database called Clue, which was an aggregation of all of the driver records for U.S. individuals. When you anonymize the data and present it back to the insurance companies, they were able to then correctly price the risk of a insurance policy to a driver and factor out the lemons. So no longer were the lemons able to jump from one player to the other and take that risk along with them and cause losses for that particular insurance company. They were appropriately now valuing the risk and pricing the policies for those consumers who were good drivers and those who weren't. So you open up real opportunities when these companies are willing to share that sort of data, even if, you know, they don't know where it comes from. There's value in getting the macro view of the market with some of the nuances. So absolutely.
And as you said, the rising tide carries all ships. And I would say for grocery specifically globally, the rising tide of high frequency FMCG consumer data and how it flows across the stakeholders will rise retail and brand FMCG.
Let's take that. You were going to peel the onion on that and how FMCG relates to platforms. Peel that onion for us so the audience understands why this data is important.
So the reason why FMCG data is so important is that if you want to understand anything, any single trend for either demographic, geographic, you want to understand an economy, that data shows up in grocery before it shows up in any other data set. I know if your wife is pregnant, because the first thing you're going to buy is a pregnancy test or pregnancy vitamins. I will know if you're going bald, because the first thing you're buying is Regain, right? Like, you will see the trend in consumer behavior before it appears anywhere else, because the frequency of purchasing groceries is so high. There's nothing that you buy and I buy more frequently, you know? And so that's one key aspect of it, is that the insight that it provides to you is really rich. Now, the other piece of it is that it's fairly safe to say that the future of e-commerce and the future of interface is voice. And we know that the technology is coming, not quite there yet, but Google Assistant and Alexa are really making strides. I think we can all agree with that. Mm-hmm. Now, when you're developing an AI, the way in which you build AI and the way in which you optimize it and teach it is training data. And the most high frequency the training data, the better. So you want as high frequency training data set as possible. And so when you think about it, there's only probably five companies in the world that have a meaningful opportunity to own the voice sector. Okay, so that's Google, Google Assistant, Amazon, Alexa. I think you could throw Facebook in there. You could also throw Netflix, Alibaba, and Tencent. They're probably the biggest platforms that have a meaningful opportunity for voice. And the reason being, one, they're probably the platforms that have the most monthly transactional volume data sets. So they have the most amount of data and the most amount of voluminous data coming through their platforms on a monthly basis from various different sources. Now, is it a coincidence that Amazon bought Whole Foods and started moving into a high frequency FMCG consumer data set? You could say that they bought it because they want the distribution or they were really crap at fresh food, all true. But I would tell you that the single biggest reason for them to get into that space is the data set. And it just adds a whole other layer. Google launched Google Express 6 months after the Whole Foods deal. Alibaba invested $3 billion in Asia's largest supermarket chain. You know, is anyone else seeing what I'm seeing? Mm-hmm. Like this is a very clear trend towards platforms trying to get into FMCG consumer. And it's because of the data, you know? And so I think that's the really interesting part about all of this, is that how much utility does that data set really provide? Logistics for sure. Yeah, sales for sure. But what else does it give? And I think that's the question that we're going to see answered probably in the next 25 years.
Google, prior to making some of those purchases, had developed algorithms that analyzed your grocery receipts. They could predict the number of people who lived in the house. They could tell you the clothing size. They could tell you a ton about each individual just by analyzing those receipts. So you're absolutely right. The data becomes to our economy what oil was to the prior decade, the prior 100 years. Data is going to be that for the next 100 years, because it is the lifeblood to help companies understand how to get full value out of markets. Absent that, you know, there's a lot of leftover capacity in just about everything we do.
Exactly. And if you think about it, the likes of Google don't have that grocery data. The likes of, no one fucking Googles butter. That right. doesn't really happen. Most people explore and discover products in the grocery store.
Right.
Right. And so there's a whole data set there that, you know, the Amazons and the Googles and the Facebooks of this world don't get access to. And the reason that the way they can get access to it is they can buy into these platforms or grocery retailers if they're a platform themselves. And that's the interesting dynamics that are happening here. And I think what's so cool about this is that when you look at, okay, Amazon start moving in here and they're buying grocery retailers, then you have Target acquire Shipt. You have a traditional linear corporation play the platform game. They acquire a platform. And they don't even absorb it. They actually keep it as a multi-retailer mm-hmm. platform,
mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Right? You have Walmart by Flipkart. Mm-hmm. So it's how do you play in this game? You fight platform with platform.
That's right.
The reason being is that platform is the dominant economic model, and that's why these businesses are making these moves at a global scale, and I'm fascinated by it.
Do you see your business model evolving into that of a traditional data player like Equifax? That Clue database that I mentioned earlier that was at ChoicePoint, it was the single most valuable product the company had. When the company was acquired by LexisNexis, the word on the street was they bought the company to get to that database. It represented 70% of the company's revenues and a higher percent of the profits. And it was contributory data. It was data that they didn't even have to pay for. Do you see your business model evolving from collecting money off the transaction and monetizing that data that we're talking about?
Yeah, for sure. You see, the challenge with grocery retail is that it's deeply, deeply expensive, right? Because if you look at grocery, the important thing is to understand the history of grocery. You know, the very first self-service supermarket was actually created and founded in Tennessee, right? The Piggly Wiggly was the very first self-service supermarket. Up until that point, people went to separate stores to buy their dairy, their bread, and all the rest. Or you went to a grocer and you would stand at the desk and a grocery boy would run around, fill your bag for you and bring it to you. The self-service supermarket model was a great innovation whereby Clarence Saunders, the founder of Piggly Wiggly, decided to pilot high, sell it low for the first time, right? And let the customer do the work.
Right.
This was the big innovation, right? So they remove all the operational cost and they'll drive higher levels of throughput by getting the customer to do all the work. So you go to this side of the warehouse to get your milk, this side of the warehouse to get your bread. They want to merchandise everything in between so that you have to impulse purchase and collect everything along the way. Now, I'm going to start taking people off the tills because I can't afford to pay people. So you're going to have a load of empty tills. I'm going to install self-checkout tills. I want you to check yourself out. And you know what? You better bring back that trolley or I'm going to keep your dollar. Right. Okay, so it's this whole effort of placing this stripping away value to a certain degree of customer experience and service, getting the customer to do all the work. And so what that did was that essentially removed all metrics of value for the customer and made the grocery industry become heavily price focused. Because any economist will tell you, Mark, if you take every metric of value away from a marketplace, one metric will always remain and become the sole deciding factor.
Price,
correctly. You know, so we've been running with this model in grocery for 106 years, right? That's the model. And so now they're trying to move into online. And what happened in Europe is they took the web van model and they told customers that online grocery does not cost anymore. You pay a small delivery fee, but we won't charge anymore, even though you need an entirely new infrastructure to actually go and pick these items because customers aren't doing it themselves. You have to pay for the delivery, you have to pay for the picking, you know, all of this extra cost. And retail, for some reason, totally miseducated the customer on that and really have now found themselves in a really tough situation because you have a business like Amazon, it's a completely different business model, and they can afford to sell everything for free.
Right.
They don't make money on the things that they sell. They make 20% of their money off AWS, for God's sake. Right?
Right.
And so they're in a position to be able to cut pricing like no other because their sheer size. They are a galactically larger business than most of these large corporations. And if it comes to a price game, we know who's going to win. You know, might is right in this sector. So when you look at the types of value that we're bringing to the market, and you ask us, you know, where do I see the business going? You know, our ambition is to be the largest shared infrastructure for grocery retailers to compete and be able to service customers with same day, all the digital and logistical capabilities of Amazon. And the only way they can do that is by sharing infrastructure, because none of them are large enough to be able to compete on their own against this player. And so if you look at it, and I'll take it closer to home, you look at the US, the number one online grocery platform is Instacart. Mm-hmm. And the reason it's Instacart is that Instacart is a collection. It's a co-op of 400 or 500 retailers, large and small, all combining and collaborating to compete against Amazon.
Right. Fascinating. It makes sense. Right, right. Absolutely. Absolutely. You mentioned Shipt. They recently expanded outside of grocery and started taking on non-grocery items like CVS, the drug delivery.
Yeah.
With your platform, you certainly can manage those types of transactions as well. Do you see that as an opportunity area?
So this is about network management and balancing. The only other category that I would consider, I'm not surprised they've got it, is pharmaceutical. And the reason being is that what you want in a network is base load.
Right.
So in any network, you look for base load, and that's then your guaranteed base load on a regular basis. And pharmaceutical has great frequency.
Right.
You have prescriptions, monthly prescriptions. You know, it's very predictable, incredibly right. forecastable. And that provides a really nice base load where more volatile grocery can sit on top.
Right. And for the audience that don't understand base load, in the electric utility market, you have to have a certain amount of customers who are going to turn the light on every day in order for them to justify building a $10 million, $20 million
generator,
coal-fired plant. And so if you don't have that baseload, that predictable demand that starts at a certain time of day and ends at a certain time of day, you don't build that generator. Right. And in this case, you got to have predictable volume so that the economics work in order for you to play the strategies of those outlying opportunities within
Correct.
That market.
Now, that being said, grocery is the largest single transactional volume market you can get into. So actually, grocery as by itself can service this market very successfully. And I would say the reason you see the likes of Postmates and DoorDash moving into every different vertical, they all started in hot food delivery. And
right.
hot food delivery is actually not a great category. They have a serious Batman problem. I'll explain. Batman ears, spike
right.
at lunch, spike at dinner, dead on either side.
Right.
And when you're dealing with a decentralized labor force, this comes back to the sharing economy piece. You know, it's incredibly important that you're able to provide consistency of access to labor, because what happens in the hot food industry, and you've seen a lot of friction within the Uber Eats, the Deliveroos, the DoorDashes, the Postmates, is that they say, you know what, I've got lots of work for you. Come. Got lots of work. Lunch is over. Okay, can you please go away?
Right.
Come back in 4 hours, dinner time. And you as the person who's provided labor, you're like, well, I made myself available for work. Mm-hmm. Where am I supposed to go for 4 hours? I don't have that level of flexibility where I can just, you know, do work now and then go back later. I need stable income. And so the hot food delivery suffers majorly from that baseload issue, where it has these volatile spikes on either side. And so what you see with these players now is they're trying to add in more categories. But of course, they've built an infrastructure around short delivery windows and small delivery baskets, whereas grocery is typically a large basket, $80 to $100, with 40 items in it. So their infrastructure is not built for it. Their algorithms aren't built for it. Everything about their technology stack is built for a completely different vertical. So you see them shoehorning these different categories in and ultimately underperforming and not being able to get profitable because they're trying to be everything to everyone. And again, that's one of the reasons why, you know, ourselves, Buyme, we're entirely focused and obsessed with grocery FMCG. We've no interest in competing in any other vertical because we're the best at what we do. And it's because we only do that, you know?
Right. You're Iron Man. You're not Batman.
I'm going to take that.
Let's talk about what's in the future. You now have this great partnership with the German discount grocer.
Lidl.
Yeah,
they're the largest grocer in Europe.
Okay. Tell us about where that takes you. You said you just wrapped up a round. I think you raised $9 million for a UK expansion. Let's talk through where you go next.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, look, expansion for us is the name of the game. You know, this is our first time expanding outside our own country. And we've just launched into the UK. And we have, you know, a terrific partnership with Lidl. As I said, largest grocer in Europe. Their parent company, the Schwarz Group, does about 100 billion a year turnover. They dwarf every other retailer in the market. They have an incredibly global view. They operate in the US. They actually have a US operation, and they've worked with Shift in the US. So they're firm believers in this model and this strategy to compete in the online channel. And we've also just signed a partnership with Co-op, which is one of the top five grocery retailers in the UK. And so, you know, for us, it's really about expansion. It's about growth. It's about really showing that we can achieve product market fit in new territories. And as I said, you know, our goal is to be the largest shared infrastructure in Europe. And right now, we have our eye on about 15 cities in the not too distant future that we're going to be expanding to.
So with that, that means you're going to be serving 2-3 more, maybe even 5 million people at the end of that sort of expansion, because you're roughly at 500,000 to
possibly even more. So yeah, so right. So Ireland has a population of 4.5 million, I believe. With Dublin being our capital city, where we have about 1.2 million people already. So we're going to extend our reach in Dublin and launch in a number of other cities in Ireland. But the UK is 10 times larger than Ireland. So there's 42 million people, I believe, in the UK. So our population reach would be significantly above, in terms of total households' ability to service, would be significantly above 5 million, I would say, at that time.
One question I want to throw out before we wrap up. Now sure. that you have built this company and you're in the midst of rapid expansion, if you had the opportunity to go back and redo the company, knowing what you know now, what would you do different?
Great question. Absolutely nothing.
Wow.
And the last, like, if I look back, like, we had a very, very challenging start. Like, we were a year early into the market. We launched in February 2016. And for the first year of our existence, one of the largest grocery retailers in Ireland tried to kill us. They took legal action against us. They lodged complaints with the advertising regulators against us. They claimed our business was misleading consumers. Like, they went to all lengths to try and get us shut down. And I couldn't understand it. You know, our goal was to be an ally to retail. And they were treating us like a disruptor. And so we ended up having to really take on that role of disruption. And we did focus on disrupting. And it was only a year later when Amazon bought Whole Foods, and all of a sudden the market really started to shift in our direction. And retail realized that there was a big threat, a real threat, and that if you considered Amazon to be a tsunami, Buy Me might well be a surfboard. Mm. And so this is the change dynamic. Now, if you ask me, is there anything that I could have been more aware of in the early days? And maybe if I was to do one thing differently, I underestimated how hard it would be to raise capital in Ireland for a consumer business. And the reason being is that Ireland is very famous for great businesses, but not consumer businesses. We do great pharmaceutical, great med tech, great SaaS companies. But when it comes to consumer, we're a very small market. And so we don't typically build big consumer businesses because we just don't have a big consumer market, right? Right. And so when I went out to try and raise capital, when I started this business, you know, I quit my job in Salesforce. I became our first grocery delivery person. And I raised 100,000 euros, 25,000 from my friends and family, 25,000 euros from one angel investor, and 50,000 euros from the Enterprise Ireland, which is the, you know, government investment vehicle. And that 100,000 euros was what I figured enough to get me 12 months of operations, where I'd be able to raise 1 million euros of a seed round, which in Ireland's terms is quite big. In the US, £1 million is very small for a seed round. But again, Ireland is a different investment environment, smaller investor networks. It took me 2 years to raise 850,000 euros.
Wow.
And we ran out of money in June of 2017.
Hmm.
And the only reason we managed to survive was that Unilever, one of the largest CPG brands in the world, they own Ben & Jerry's, which is probably the best known American brand. They actually acquired 3% of the company in June of 2017 to keep us alive because they thought what we were doing was interesting.
Wow. I'm going to go buy some Ben & Jerry's today.
You should. You should. They're a great brand.
Yes. I mean, if they help save you guys, I mean, this is such a fascinating story. So right at the brink, they come in and, had they not, imagine all the missed opportunities.
Would have been done. I remember I sat in a Starbucks for the day. I had 1,200 euros left in the account. I had one shopper working with me at that time, myself and another guy doing the orders. I paid him his salary for the week, and that was it. That was, I had no more money left, and it was going to be either that deal would happen, or I was going to have to get a job. And so I sat there for the whole day, refreshing the bank account, waiting for their money to land, because they told me it was done. I had signed the deals and the contracts, but you don't believe it until the money lands. Anything can happen. And sure enough, at 4:30 p.m., their money arrived in the account, and I went back to work. We were dead at that time. And only for them stepping in as an activist investor to really help seed us, we wouldn't have made it to where we are today. So it just tells you how important it is to really look at the big picture, to build relationships with other stakeholders, because while one retailer was killing us, another stakeholder in the market was helping us, and so that's always important to bear in mind, particularly at the early stages of a business.
What other advice would you give to a non-technical founder that's looking to launch a platform?
Get a technical founder. no, it's true. Like the realistic aspect is I'm not technical either. I'm financial. But I was lucky enough to meet my co-founder Art. Actually, and it's very coincidental, Mark. My previous business to buy me was a company called PayMe. I'm not very creative with names. And it was a fingerprint payment system. So you could link your fingerprint to your credit card. And I put this project out and Art bid for it. And I worked with Art, and I paid him to build the software for me. And that business died a death. I took it behind the barn. And when I went back to Art with the idea for Buy Me, he said, "Oh, I love this. I'd love to partner with you." For me, it was a no-brainer, because I knew I needed a technical co-founder. Because when an investor is looking at you, there's two things. One, two co-founders, it de-risks the deal, because if one person can't cut it, at least you still have one person still in the mix. But also, you need to complement your skill sets. If you're commercial, if you're financial, great. You need those skills too. You need to be able to go out and sell the product. You need to be able to go out and raise the capital to fund it. But you do need someone who can spend the time building it. So take the time to find a technical co-founder. You'll be taken more seriously if you're able to recruit good technical people into your business in the early stages, particularly when it's just an idea.
Devin, this has been fascinating. This has been fun. This is like almost finding my brother. Wow.
Likewise, dude.
Exactly. I'm sure others are going to find you fascinating. How can they find you on social media? How can they follow your company? Sure. I'm sure when it gets to the States, there are going to be others who want to be a part of this. Tell us how we can find out more.
Sure. So look, my handle is very, very simple. You can get me at Devin Hughes on Twitter or Devin Hughes on Instagram. You can find me on LinkedIn, and Buy Me is buyme.eu, buyme.eu. More than happy for people to follow along the journey.
Absolutely. Well, thank you again for coming on the podcast. This has been fascinating, exhilarating, and I'm sure all the entrepreneurs who are following in your footsteps are going to learn a thing or two about how to build a really effective business.
Thank you very much, Mark. Thanks for having me on.
I want to thank Devin Hughes for coming on the podcast. This was a fascinating episode. I enjoyed it thoroughly, and I hope you did too. If you did, please support the show by liking it, rating it, and subscribing. I'd also appreciate a few comments. That helps us with those pesky algorithms. It helps us move up in the rankings. What's next for Gigging Everything in the Sharing Economy podcast? Well, as I mentioned in the opener, Eleanor Tucker will join me as co-host on Gigging News, and that episode will post on July 21st. After that, the next episode is with the Rideshare Mechanics. Yeah, I talked to the CEO and CMO about their business and ways they're going to pivot out of the ride-sharing market and into other sectors. A fascinating interview. You don't want to miss that. If you like Gigging Everything in the Sharing Economy podcast, you may also like some of my other podcasts, like Gorillapreneur, The Art of Waging Small Business Warfare. If you're an entrepreneur and a business maverick, that podcast is for you. If you're a corporate exec that's not ready to put your toe in the entrepreneurial pool, Career Coaching X's and O's might be the podcast for you. It'll help you secure that corner office. I'm proud of that podcast. We were just ranked in the top 10 of all coaching podcasts on the web. Check us out, Career Coaching X's and O's. Finally, I want to let you know that we have Gorillapreneur merchandise. Yes, Gorillapreneur hats and t-shirts that say disrupt or die. Gorillapreneur on the front, disrupt or die on the back. Get your hat or t-shirt and show the world that you're ready to take on the Goliath. I'll put a link to our shop where you can buy that merchandise in the show notes. Remember, guys, just like the Gorillapreneur t-shirts and hats say, disrupt or die. Till next time, peace.